Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, May 12th, Mother's Day, 2019. This is Happy Mother's Day. This is episode 1591. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Peak PTT, the leading provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. For instant, always-on nationwide communications, visit peakptt.com and use the promo code TWIT for 15% off. And by FreshBooks, the number one accounting software in the cloud for self-employed professionals and their teams. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/techguy. And by PryLock Security. Teach your employees how to keep your company secure by avoiding phishing emails, candy drops, and social engineering. Show them how and why hackers attack with training from PryLock. Go to PryLock.com/TWIT and use the promo code Leo to save 30%. Well, happy Mother's Day. Hey. How are you mothers doing? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, suitable gifts for mom of all kinds. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my phone number. 888-827-5536. That would be toll free if you're in the U.S. or Canada, but you could still call free. But you have to have some sort of Skype out or some sort of way of calling a phone internationally if you want to call from anywhere else in the world. And we do get calls from all over the world, and I more than welcome them. 8888 Ask Leo, our website. And it's important to note this, because if you note this, you need note nothing else. Because everything is up there. It's techguylabs.com. So if you hear something and you want to write it down, you don't have to. Just techguylabs.com. If you start to shout at the radio saying, Leo, you're wrong, or I've got a better idea, or what about? No need to shout. Just go to techguylabs.com. It's free. There's no sign up. You can. Every show is there. This is episode, if you want to narrow it down, 1,591. You go to that page and you can break it up into hours and hours into segments, and easy to find what you want. You can even read the comments, my comments and links and stuff, but there's even audio and video after the fact. We'll put that up there too. TechGuyLabs.com. No charge. It's my gift to you on this Mother's Day. So Google and Microsoft both had events this week. Google I.O., Microsoft Build, their developer conferences. And, Microsoft's event was kind of predictably very business-focused. We call it enterprise computing.
Yeah, and I call it boring.
I mean, if you're running an IT department and you're running a business, yeah, of course, that's your bread and butter. You're interested. It's just, to me, I'm more interested in other stuff. Consumer stuff. And Google had a lot of consumer stuff to talk about. They showed some, they have a new phone, the Pixel 3a, which everybody seems to like quite a bit. The price is right anyway. I think it's Google acknowledging that maybe they reached too far with an $800 smartphone, the Pixel 3 last year. So, no, I'm not talking to you. Sorry. say the G word and it will appear. It's like Beetlejuice. You say it three times, you're guaranteed. It will appear. In any event, what was I saying? What was I talking about? Google. The biggest thing they talked about was kind of buried. This is the thing I think is a little disappointing. I mean, they showed many things. They showed really what I enjoyed about Google's I.O. keynote, which was on Tuesday, was they showed how technologies from Google are being used to make lives better. They showed a little mini documentary about a woman in India who is illiterate, who can't read, but who can use her phone, in particular her Google Lens and her Google Assistant, to read signs, to follow what's going on. She said, I used to have to ask somebody to read for me, but now my phone will do it. That's cool. That's cool. And then they showed how Google Assistant can be trained with people who have difficulty speaking. They showed a little mini documentary about a guy named Dmitry, who I think is actually a Google engineer, but in any event, Dmitry is not only Russian-speaking, but has a severe speech impediment. And so normally, you know, if you don't speak kind of standard enunciated English, these voice assistants don't do a very good job. If you're Scottish, they don't understand a word you're saying. Of course, neither does anybody else. But they were able to use Dmitry, and since he works for Google, I think he was able to spend some time doing this. They said that we took 15,000 voice samples. Wow, that's a long time. And but they were able to get the assistant so it could understand him. And even more useful, he could use it to dictate so people could see if, you know, basically subtitle your life. I thought that was kind of cool. So they showed a lot of things like that. As did Microsoft, you know, the future is now and computing is going to change your life. But then they did something that I think is going to resound a little bit as people figure it out. They announced that Nest, the Nest brand, Nest, you know, that was the started with a smart thermostat. Remember that? And then Nest has cameras now. They basically announced that Nest is now Google. And Google's going to use the Nest. No, no, I'm not. I'm not talking to you. How do I get to stop doing that? Help me, tech guy. Go away. I'm not talking to you. The I'll just say the G word. How about that? The Nest stuff is now Google Nest stuff, and the Nest cameras are now Google Nest cameras. And so, big deal. It's the branding, right? Well. Yeah, except that it looks like the data that these devices collect now belongs to Google entirely. There's no... In fact, for a long time, Nest, which was acquired by Google, said, oh, no, don't worry, we're independent. Google's never getting that information from our cameras and our thermostat stuff. Well, guess what? It's not true anymore. And the new branding is like, well, how about the Nest X Yale lock with Google Nest Connect? That's the name of the door lock now. Used to be just the Nest lock. Well, okay. Google's new, they announced a new speaker with a camera and a screen, the Google Nest Hub Max. Besides the ungainly naming, the real issue is that works with Nest, which is a smart home platform that would allow your Nest devices to act as a hub and coordinate other smart home products, it's winding down. Now it's just going to be works with Google Assistant. And honestly, I'm wondering if people who invested, and this is a problem with, it's just going to be an ongoing problem with Internet of Things devices and mainly with smart home and smart home integration, is you spend a lot of money, you get everything working, and then they change it. It doesn't work anymore. So it's now no longer works with Nest. It's works with Google Assistant. And apparently, you should read the privacy policy, but apparently Nest data, which is lots of stuff from motion sensors, cameras, microphones, now belongs to Google. It's all Google's. That's okay. I don't mind. As you can see, I have Google listening. I have Amazon listening. I have everybody listening in. I'm not averse to these things. But I think a lot of people who are, this is going to slow down adoption. I don't understand it. Google really, at this event, made no bones about the fact that, well, yes, we collect a lot of data about you. And you'll be glad. It's to your benefit. Everything we know about you makes us better. They showed how you could ask Google, what should I cook tonight? And it would show you recipes and things to cook based on what it knows about you, which is apparently quite a bit. Isn't that great? Yeah. I mean, I like it. But I think more and more people are getting more and more worried about this. Facebook saying privacy is the future. Apple saying we keep everything private. Even Microsoft saying privacy is number one. Google saying, privacy, overrated. Look what we can do with everything we know about you. Who's going to win that one? 8888 ask Leo. I don't know. For me, I'm going with Google. Let go and let Google. That's my philosophy. They want to know everything about me. What could possibly go wrong? You walk in, I mean, it's cool. You walk into an airport, it says, oh, here's where your gate is because I know what flight you're on. By the way, the weather where you're going is this, and your hotel is waiting for you because they know it all. What could possibly go? There's nothing wrong with that, right? Or not. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk high tech. I haven't reviewed it. I've played with it. I'm sure Jason Howell's review. We did a first look, and Jason Howell will have a further review. But basically, it's great for the price. You know, it's a miracle. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you unbreakable Kimmy Schaffer. Kimmy, don't take no Schaffer. Hello, Kim.
Good morning. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. Did you do something for Mom?
Not yet, but I've got three helium balloons in the car.
That's all it takes, baby.
Very low tech.
Three helium balloons. I'm ready.
Yep.
So, hey, how you doing?
Good. How are
you? You kind of getting over the glow now of the victorious Warriors.
Well, it'll start again this week.
Starts all over. It's a long process, isn't it? This isn't even
it's been going on
finals.
Since early April.
Gemini Christmas.
Yeah, it is a long process. It goes through June if they make it all the way. So
what?
Yeah.
June.
Yeah, the parade's in June.
June. Yeah, basketball season's getting longer and longer. It feels like. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, anywho, I know their Sharks are playing too. So the Bay Area.
Yeah, they won last night.
Yeah, Bay Area is very excited.
Got the dynasty thing going again. Hopefully.
Yeah, and the Giants.
Not so much.
They have a dynasty, but of a different sort. So, who should I start with? You've been answering the phones. I see a lot of calls on the board.
How about Chris in Rhode Island using a Note 8 tablet for GPS? He's a truck driver, but I think it's kind of conking out, and he's thinking, what's going to be his next step for GPS?
All right. Okay. Fair enough. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Chris.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm great. Welcome to the show.
What are you sending rain out here to Rhode Island?
Oh, man. That's because my mom's out there, and she loves the April flowers. April showers. They bring May flowers. So
yeah, I've fallen in love with a Note 8 for a GPS.
Yeah.
But it's getting a little old.
Well, it is. Let's see. The Note 9 came out, right? Or no. Yeah, the Note 9 came out. And I have the Note 9. I love that. But here's the good news.
The tablet.
Oh, the tablet, not the phone.
The tablet. This is several years old.
Yeah.
I got it for $150 several years ago.
Well, that's a good deal.
Yeah.
Well, Samsung still makes tablets, you know, and they make
I'm looking for one that has a cell in it. Cell service.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Because so you need LTE. They do have LTE tabs, Galaxy tabs.
Mm-hmm.
So and when you have LTE, it turns out that radio not only includes the data, it also includes GPS, and that's pretty typical on tablets. That if they don't have the data, they're not going to have the GPS. I think your best bet is to go to your carrier store. Who's your carrier?
AT&T.
Yeah, they'll have probably a deal in order to keep you in the fold. They'll have deals on the, I guess the latest is the Tab S4 or the Tab A, and they'll have deals on the LTE versions because they want you to use the LTE versions.
Yeah, they want to keep getting my
$10. That's right. That's it. They get your money, so it's worth it for them. So I think when you're buying a tablet nowadays, not a bad idea. If you're going to get a tablet as you want that has data, not a bad idea to get it through the company store. And I think these for Android tablets, these are the best. It's unfortunate because Android tablets really don't have a great reputation. The people who make Android apps just never really took to the tablets, I guess. So,
Waze works really well.
Yeah, and it's big. It's a nice big screen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great choice. So,
keeps me out of the trees.
Yeah, there's the cheap one is the Tab A that just came out, but they also have the Tab S, and I think those would be very good choices for you. They're nice and big. The A, if you want to, you know, stay in that price range, The A is a good choice. And they do have, for the S4, I'm looking at the S4 right now, they do have, it doesn't look like the Tab has LTE, but the S4 does. So that's probably the one you want, the Galaxy Tab S4. And they do offer it on AT&T. That's 10.5 inches. Is that too big for you?
I'll have to change. It might be.
Do you have a mount? Do you keep it on the dash?
Too big for me.
Yeah.
It's not too big for me. It's too big for the current holder I have.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's all sorts of things you can do. What I did is I got a metal disc that it adheres to the back of the tablet. And it's and then you get a strong magnet, and you could put the magnet on your dash somewhere. And then the tablet's very easy to put on and remove.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can have, and it's big enough to hold, you know, it's strong enough to hold a 10-inch tablet easily. But, yeah, I think they probably have
some. My luck, I'll wipe the hard drive.
No, the magnet's okay. You can use that on the tablets. No moving parts inside. People ask me that all the time. Is it all right to use magnetic mounts for my phones and this extends to tablets? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's how long I've been around this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No spinning drives anymore. Magnets are no longer a threat to your floppy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think the S4 is probably the right bet. But just go to the AT&T store, see what they offer you a deal on. Honestly, that's probably, you know, where you're going to get your biggest deal, cuz they want to keep you as a customer. And you know, I don't necessarily say threaten them, but you can always say, you know, Verizon's got this great deal across the street. I'm thinking of moving, and then they'll pony up. Dave in Salt Lake City. Hi, Dave. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing great.
What can I do for you?
Well, it's what I think I can do for you.
Oh,
you
thank you.
You
take
inspired
it.
Me.
Yes.
I've been listening to you, you know, like everybody else since the tech TV days.
Thank you.
And big fan. Last fall, you were talking about how you were going on vacation, and you had to create an operator's manual for your house sitter so they could watch TV.
A 4-page manual on how to use the TV.
Exactly.
Oy.
So, you know, it's interesting that I got through on Mother's Day because a woman who's been like a second mother to me kind of inspired me to come up with a tip. Because she's, you know, bless her heart, she's wanted to be a geek forever. We got her on an iPad. We got her on an iPhone. But she really wanted an Apple TV so she could watch it on a bigger screen.
Yeah.
But like everybody else, switching the TV remotes in the proper order to get to the input so
oh,
she can watch
man.
The Apple
what
TV.
What a mess. What a mess.
When someone, you know, in their early 80s, it's very difficult.
Yes.
So I had an idea. I went over to her house and I took pictures of all her remotes with my iPhone.
Good.
Then I opened all those pictures in markup,
oh.
and I drew boxes around the buttons, arrows pointing. Then I took pictures of the TV for every step, and when that was all done, I took all those pictures, I put them in Keynote, and then I created a PDF.
Oh, how cute. A little slideshow.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which I then saved on her iPad in iBook so she could open it up.
What a great idea. That's a great idea. Well done. And a great tip. It doesn't have to be those particular technologies, but yeah, that's a really good idea. Make a little a manual. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sorry, I had to cut you off there. We ran out of time.
Okay.
But is that the story?
No, I created an app that will do it all in one
what?
Spot.
What? So you took the next step to make an app.
Yes.
What's the name of the app?
Pixstructions.
Oh, I love it. Well, you know, we'll give you a plug. Don't worry. I'll mention that. That's awesome. Is it on the App Store?
It is. We just went live on the 30th, and we finally got the bugs all worked out. The iPad version should come in another week. There's an Android version, but I'm not real happy with the drawing tools.
Now, let me ask you how you did this. Are you a computer programmer yourself, or did you hire somebody?
No, I came to the Brick House and demoed an app that I created for my business to you about a year ago called Heads Up.
Oh yeah.
And
okay, cool.
And yeah, so I was on the phone trying to call in to give you the tip about the convoluted way of making a PDF. And when I was waiting to get on, the light bulb went off. And so I texted my software guys and said, hey, can we make an app that will do this in one place?
Is this the one from Archer?
That's it.
Oh, yep. Look at this. This is such a cool idea. Create easy photo instructions that I can't. The iPad app will even be better.
Oh, yeah, totally. It's going to use all the real estate that you get. But, you know, making the PDF was great because I could print it out or you could save it. But the thing was, is like every week I listen and the chat room or you have the answer. But how do you convey it over the radio?
Yeah.
You have these clips on the tech guy. But I thought if we could take those pictures and make a web page.
What a great idea.
With a link.
What a great idea.
You can so
it's ad supported, so it's free with ads, $1.99 if you want to take the ads out. I think that's a very fair way to do it. And it looks fantastic.
Well, thank you.
What a good idea. So you can annotate it, you can draw an arrow, you can say put this in here and
yep.
That is so cool.
And it makes a film strip and then you can drag and drop and rearrange them if you want before you do the final PDF or web page.
Oh, that's so
and
cool.
Then we create a QR code at the end that you can print like as a sticker and put it on the back of your remote.
That's brilliant.
So
nice added feature. So you put that on the back and say, you know, scan this for instructions. Brilliant.
I had an idea for Airbnb, like when you scan how to change the thermostat.
Yeah, when you go to an Airbnb, a good Airbnb often will have a notebook with all of these manuals, all these things.
But with the QR code, I found a company that's going to do laser etching on different metals and wood so you could, like, glue it next to the door when you check in.
Nice.
So.
Wow. Do you have a website or is it just the App Store?
Well, no, we're building a portal like YouTube.
Oh, nice.
So you can
share them.
People can share them.
Yeah, because that's even better because then I don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly.
That's okay, so I apologize that we ran out of time. I will give you a big plug, Dave, when we come back.
Appreciate it. I'll be coming to see you in a couple weeks.
Good.
I'm bringing you a new mat for the floor with your logo, like the one that I brought you.
Did you? Oh, that was you. Those are great. We use that. It's in the studio right now. We love it.
I got another one for the front door.
We use it because there's a little lip in the studio because we have a raised floor. We don't want anybody to trip on the lip. So we put that mat there. Oh, my God. Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate it. I'm going to give you a big fat plug when we get back.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Leo.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Leo.
Oh, look. He's got a little OBD-3 thing at the bagoggle.
We're still on OBD-2.
OBD-2. OBD-2. Nice. I made up a third one just for fun.
It's probably a Tesla exclusive.
Six? What about six? Oh, there it is. There's the mat that Dave gave us, protecting you from the lip. Is that the same one? Yeah? Nice. He's bringing us a new one for the front door. Thank you, Dave. I kept talking to Dave, and unfortunately, we ran out of time. There was more to this story. So you remember our last caller, he for his mom, he made a guidebook with pictures, a little keynote slideshow. And then he realized, you know, there's other people could use this. He actually just released an app on the iOS App Store. He's got an iPad version coming as well called PicStructions. PicStructions that makes it easy to do what he did for his mom, which is to make an app that has all the instructions on how to use something, anything you want. You can add pictures, annotations, and then even print a QR code that you could put on the back of the device or on the remote control and say, scan this for PicStructions. What a great idea. Dave, I'm sorry we ran out of time before I can give you that big fat plug. That is really cool. PicStructure, PicStructions. That's why it's nice to have skills, right? If you can code, then you got an idea. You can make it. It's car time. Sam Abulsamid is here. He's the car guy from Navigant Research, principal researcher there. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Leo. How are you today?
I am well. So it's fun to know, to think about what Sam's going to do because he Skypes in with video. I know you can't see it at home, but I can. And it's always fun because he puts behind him on the green screen something that he's going to talk about. This looks like one of those things you plug into your OBD-2 port.
That's correct.
What is it?
This is an example of a dongle. So for those who don't know what OBD-2 is, it's OBD stands for onboard diagnostics. And If you ever crawl underneath the dashboard of your car, you will find this trapezoidal connector sitting there. I think it's got about 20 pins in it. And you'll find one of these on every car built since 1996. By law, they have to have them in there. And as part of the emissions regulations, they were originally designed to have a standardized interface so that you could read diagnostic trouble codes off the car, especially those related to the emission control system.
Hey, Sam, could you move your mic a little closer? Because you're having a little trouble picking you up. Make it right up into your mouth there. This is radio, right, buddy? Look how close my mic is.
All right, I'm right on
the there. You go. That sounds much better. Okay. So this thing, you plug it into that port, but don't you need that port, or maybe not?
Well, normally you don't need it. It's there primarily as a diagnostic connector. So. You don't usually, generally when you're driving, you're not using it for anything. There's usually nothing plugged in there. And it was originally designed to plug in diagnostic tools. When your check engine light comes on your dashboard, this is how the mechanic finds out, what's wrong, what the trouble code is. And so, what they've done over the last 10 years or so is these have become fairly standardized, these adapters that you can plug in. And there's a lot of different applications for them. If your insurance company, for example, offers you a discount for sharing information about your driving patterns, what they do is they give you one of these little dongles.
It has a little
Wi-Fi connector in there. So it's got some memory. And
it monitors you.
It monitors you, yeah.
And so what does it know? What information does the OBD2 port know? What can it tell about me?
So... It basically can read all of the messages going back and forth between all of the computers that are in your car, and get all kinds of data from the sensors and everything.
So does it know how fast I'm going?
It knows how fast you're going. It knows how hard you're accelerating.
Oh, it does. Does it know how hard I'm braking?
It knows how hard you're braking.
So it knows when I jam on the brakes and come squealing.
It knows when your ABS activates and your stability control activates. So it knows all this. And these are the kinds of pieces of information that the insurance companies collect. And they put it into a model and it figures out what your risk factor is.
Yeah.
But you can also use it for a lot of other cool stuff. Like, instead of having to pay a mechanic to tell you what that check engine light is. And, a lot of times it's something fairly trivial. You can buy one of these adapters with either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi built into it.
I had for a long time, it was a Kickstarter, I think, the automatic.
They were a former sponsor, I think, of you guys.
They were. We had ads for them some years ago.
They're still around.
It was very cool. It would even do a crash alert and get you a real-time road assistance and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And so this, you can buy these for, anywhere from $10 to $25, depending on the quality of it. And there's all kinds of apps that you can get for both iOS and Android. The screenshot I have over my shoulder here is from an app called Torque Pro, which I've used for many years. And you can, most of these apps, you can customize the interface and put up dials, so you can see all the different sensor signals, so you can see your throttle position sensor and your air fuel mixture and all kinds of other things. And this one, Torque Pro, also has a plugin that you can install called Torque Recorder. So it acts like a dash cam, and then you can overlay all this different data on it and record it. So as you drive around, you can see what's going on. So if you're trying to figure out, why your car's not running right, you can record all this stuff and then, either fix it yourself or take it to a technician and show them and it can help them with the diagnosis.
This really ties back to what I was talking to at the beginning of the hour, which is on the one hand, people are worried about privacy. I mean, this thing will tell on you everything you do in the car. But on the other hand, there's value in that if you can use it, to keep track of mileage, to keep track of efficiency. There's all sorts of value to it. And we shouldn't knock reducing car insurance costs. That's pretty good, too, if you're a good driver. What is Torque Pro's privacy policy? I mean, do they...
It doesn't upload any data that I'm aware of.
So it's all yours.
It's all just stored locally on your phone.
Nice.
So and most of these other apps are similar, that they just store the data locally.
And it's a standardized thing. So does Torque Pro sell a dongle, or can you just use any other dongle?
You can use any dongle. There's a chipset called ELM 327. If you just look on Amazon or eBay or anywhere for an OBD2 adapter. they're all basically the same. They all have the same basic chipset in there, and that's they're standards, which is why they're so inexpensive.
Nice. And just a point to be made: most cars since '96 have the OBD2 port, but not all. My Tesla does, but I don't think you get the same information out of it.
All cars by law sold in the U.S. are required.
All cars by law are
required to have that connector in there, and they have a standardized set of messages.
But the Tesla doesn't seem to send all the messages.
A lot of the messages are not relevant to an EV. So things like air fuel mixture.
I guess it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. The emissions control messages are not relevant on an EV, things like that.
Pretty soon we're going to have multiple OBD2 ports in our cars as we start. It's like a cigarette lighter adapter. You know, you start to use it for a lot of things. I have a camera, the Owl Cam, that gets its power from the OBD2 port, which means I can't use it for anything else.
Yeah. What car companies are starting to do now is take the information directly from the diagnostic or from the telematics and feed that directly to insurance companies, so you don't have to use the OBD2 adapters
anymore. Ah, yes, Tesla knows everything I do.
Oh, yes.
Unfortunately, talk about a privacy. We had a problem when I first got the Tesla. We thought it was going forward when the car was in reverse. I called them. They said, "Well, let's look at the log." No, when you were talking about 11:43. No, you had it in forward. It was like, oh my god, that was. That was a clarion call.
Yeah, they collect a little more data than
they
most
know
of them.
Everything. So, Sam Abul-Samid, he is principal researcher at Navigant. He is our car guy. When's the e-tron thing? Is that next week?
It's this week. I'm flying out tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Driving it on Tuesday.
So next week, tell us how you like the new Audi electric. I'd be very curious. Yeah. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Leo.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. E-bikes are awesome. Ace, I got a pair of very affordable e-bikes from Rad Power that I really thought were quite good. I have a System 73, which is expensive and just kind of a gimmicky thing, but fun. And then for Michael, because he commutes on his e-bike, we got him a Specialized, which is very expensive. I know the Ducati is a good way to kill myself. I'm not going to. But I really like the Rad Power. I got the Rad City, which is great. And Lisa has the off-road Rad, which has big wheels. But e-bikes are so cool. They're so great. To me, it's just a revolution getting around. I just wish that cities, including Petaluma, were more bike-friendly. They really ought to be, but they're not. Our show today brought to you by this. This is so cool. Peak, push-to-talk, PTT. Peak is the number one provider of push-to-talk systems for business communications. You know, a company cell phone is fine, but it's expensive. Can be a big time waster for employees. You know what I'm saying? They're playing their break out there. They're playing their Candy Crush Saga instead of getting the work done. And it's true that push-to-talk phone calls or conversations are shorter and more to the point. PTT, push-to-talk. Peak provides advanced IP-based, internet-based push-to-talk systems for small, medium, and large businesses. Leverage the internet's cellular data and Wi-Fi networks to transmit voice over the internet. Instant talk, instant location monitoring. You get emergency alert notifications. There's a couple of different models. This is the rugged handset, the PTT 584G, the Everest. 5 nines of network availability, very low latency. That's important. You know, when you push, you want it to go through right away. In fact, it's better than most of the other guys, frankly. PC-based dispatch console, so you can have a dispatcher at the central office, keeping an eye on where everybody is. There's an emergency button. There's a flashlight on this one, which I love. Push-to-talk calls last an average of 15 seconds versus 50 seconds for traditional calls because they're to the point. You can back up here to make sure you watch out for that signpost over there instead of, hey, how you doing? How's the kids? How's the family? It's getting the job done. They're rugged, too. They're built to withstand dirt, water, extreme temperatures. There's no billing. Contract is month to month. Actually, this is the Everest. This is the K2. The Everest is really compact, no bigger than a cell phone. Goes right on your belt. The K2, this is a big puppy. I love this guy. It provides an affordable walkie-talkie-style handset. This is the PTT84G. There are also Android and iOS apps and PC dispatch software, as I mentioned. And then this is the Everest. This is it's actually so cool and small, and yet, and convenient, and yet very, very efficient. Get in touch faster, operate more efficiently. Peak PTT. The website is peakptt.com. And we're going to get you 15% off at checkout if you use the promo code TWIT. Peakptt.com, promo code TWIT. 15% off. This is a great solution for any business that needs to keep in touch with its employees. Peakptt.com. We thank PTT.com for supporting us with their advertising. We thank you for supporting us by using that offer code TWIT, and you'll get 15% off too. PEAKPTT.com. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Old chef guy, Richard from up the coast of peace. Hi, Richard.
Greetings.
Greetings, my friend.
My first question is, I have two Google questions and then possibly a third question. Why
won't
Google let us name our devices so that my Lenovo, my Pixel C, and my Pixel XL 2XL all don't bark at the same time?
Yeah, because it's the same, and it's the same with Amazon. The problem is that these limited trigger words, at least Amazon gives you a few choices. You can do computer, the A word, Amazon, or Echo. Google, it's just okay, you know who. And you saw my problem. Every time I say the word Giuseppe, the thing goes off. So I agree with you. Now, the funny thing is we know you can do it because years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, Motorola came out with a phone. I loved it, called the Moto X.
I love the Moto X. I still have two.
And you could have your own trigger word on anything you wanted. Mine was, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. And the reason I made it so long is that way it wouldn't go off by accident, except if I'm occasionally watching episode 4 of Star Wars. But other than that, it didn't go off. And there's, you absolutely, in fact, more than just different names, it'd be nice to make them longer so that you get fewer false triggers and all that. So why doesn't Google do it? They certainly could do it in the phones. If the Moto X could do it, there's no reason why modern phones with much more horsepower, more memory, more storage couldn't. I can understand why maybe the Google Assistants don't, because those are lower, slower processors. Maybe they don't want to be customizable in that way. If you think about it, the way these things work is the Amazon Echo, the Google Assistant, Siri, all the voice assistants do pretty much the same thing. They have stored in their firmware a waveform of what the words look like, what Siri looks like, what Echo looks like, you know, what the trigger words look like. And it's going to be a fairly loose waveform because it's voice independent, right? And so what they're doing is that they are constantly on. They're not sending information back to the home office, but they are looking at the microphone's always on, looking at all the audio inputs. If they can match it up to that waveform, they go, I've been triggered. Immediately, they'll start sending everything after that to the home office for processing. So I think it really comes down to they don't want to spend the memory. Maybe it's a marketing thing that I completely agree with you. Why, Richard, why don't they allow this? It's silly. It's a problem.
It's really annoying.
It's really annoying. And I really feel bad for any young lady's name. By the way, name has gone way down as the name of choice for baby girls born in the last few years for a very good reason. But, you know, there are a lot of teenage girls and older who are stuck with it. I feel really bad for them. My friend Alex Lindsay, he says we can't use our Echoes with the A word. We have to use a different word because every time somebody says, hey, Alex, Amazon wakes up. So this is clearly a problem. I'm sure this will be changed. We know it can happen because of the Moto X. But And I'm just unclear, and I don't know why every journalist who ever talks to anybody from these companies doesn't say, please, why do you do this? This is you're foisting this on people. Maybe it's marketing. Maybe they just want everybody to say Alexa. I don't know.
I'm not sure. So my secondary question is, I hear tricky rumors about what might be happening with Google Music.
Uh-oh.
And years ago, I uploaded about probably between 30 and 40,000 tracks to the old days when you could upload music.
Yep,
so that's
as did
in
I.
the Google sphere up there.
Yep.
And if they suddenly go, oh, no more Google Music, we're moving everything to YouTube, where are all my tracks?
Yeah, what I don't do think I do? They will do that, but because people like you and me, by the way, I did exactly the same thing, will really be upset. The good news is storage is cheap. I think, if anything, what they're going to do is rebrand, but I don't think they'll suddenly say, oh, and all that stuff that you've been storing, those the limit now is 50,000 songs that you can store. We're going to just throw those out. Google, you never know. But I think that if they do rebranding, and I do hear same kinds of rumors, the drumbeat, that maybe they're going to change the name of, I don't even remember what it's called. It's not a very good name. Google Music, is that it? I don't know. They might change it to...
I'm not sure.
To, remember they had YouTube Red and they got rid of that too, and now it's YouTube. I don't know. It's,
yeah.
Google, don't get me started.
No. So, well, let me ask a sort of a...
And Google, I think it's... Google Play Music is not the best name. So if they rebrand it, fine. But they better not throw out my songs.
Yeah. And so do I want to build an external... I have a Synology router.
Well, you absolutely should have a copy somewhere besides Google. I hope you do.
Well, I have the original CDs. I have cases of original CDs, but I haven't...
Well, that's no good.
Thank you. Exactly. Should I put an external drive on my Synology and dump them all there for backup?
Yeah, because honestly, I mean, I like you, I have at least 50,000 songs. I've uploaded 50,000 to YouTube or Google Music. But,
right.
But that's 100 gigabytes or so. It's not a lot of storage. Easily done. And you should treat the music you've digitized kind of like your photos. It's something you don't want to lose. So that's exactly what I do. I have it synchronized. And it's easy to do with Synology as a network-attached storage device, one that I like. Obviously, you do too. But almost any device like that will allow you to automatically synchronize. So I synchronize my music library not only with Google but also with my local hard drive. And you should do that with anything precious because you just don't know. I mean, there's even situations where people have gotten banned from Google. Where Google says, no, you know, you misused your account, rightly or wrongly, there's really no appeal. And they've lost, you know, anything that's stored up there. So always back up anything. Don't trust any cloud service as your one and only copy. Even Carbonite, even OneDrive, even Apple's iCloud. You just, it would be foolish to do that. So make sure you have a local copy, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. It's great to talk to you, old chef guy. Do you still cook? Yeah. Or were you a chef?
I was a chef for 20 years, and I mostly am very popular during the holidays.
Yes.
The restaurant that I cooked in was out in Sebastopol, and we prepared Thanksgiving every day. So on Thanksgiving, we'd cook for about 500.
Oh,
so I can cook turkey in my sleep.
What was the name of that?
It was called Vast's Country Dining.
Oh, sounds like heaven. Sounds like absolute heaven.
It was amazing.
It sounds
wonderful. No, I like to go to people's houses with nice kitchens and make a mess and cook whatever they want.
Anytime. Come on over, Richard.
your kitchen, I can't imagine.
I have a nice kitchen with all the gear.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, it's great to talk to you again. Take care, Richard.
Thank you.
Great questions, really good ones. I'm reading an article on Tom's Guide from last month. Please, Google, don't replace Play Music with YouTube Music. I honestly think it would be a naming thing, I hope. I don't think this would be a good thing to do, especially that wonderful feature of uploading your own music. Because Google Play Music, like Apple's iTunes and all the others, has about 40 million songs, pretty much every song ever, Spotify. But has this unique feature. Apple has it too for $25 of letting you upload all your own music as well. If it matches, well, they don't have to store a copy. But if it's unique stuff that you've recorded or live performances they don't have, that's a nice thing. That means your streaming library can be very nice, very complete. I'd hate for them to change that. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. Everything with a chip in it. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number, the website, techguylabs.com. That's free, that's open, no sign up. Please take advantage of it because that's the easiest way to find out. What did he say? Or even add your comments. We appreciate that too. Steve Trabuco Canyon, California is next. Hello, Steve. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Howdy, Leo.
Hey, Steve.
Oh, I've got something weird for you today.
Oh, good. I love the weird ones.
50th birthday for my wife, so I'm taking her on a trip.
How nice. Happy birthday.
Just a little bit out of the country to Cabo.
Oh, nice.
And I just happened to call AT&T to see a mobile service down there.
By the way, these are my favorite gifts where you benefit too. I'm doing it for you, honey.
Well, it's going to be a great trip.
It's going to be a great trip.
If we wish to use our mobile phones, it will be there for a week. So they wanted to charge us $10 a day per line. $60 each line, we could have a month's worth of use with limited data.
Yeah.
I'd rather not give the evil Death Star entity $140 to use.
I don't blame you. So there's a few things you can do. It's one of the reasons, by the way, I maintain a T-Mobile account and a Google Fi account. In both cases, you get international calling, international texting, and data, a certain amount of data for free. With Google Fi, it's as if you're in the country. It's exactly the same billing structure.
I've got even more for you.
Yeah.
I brought my AT&T 3G micro cell with you, which I have to use out here in the canyon to get coverage at home.
Right.
Wondering if that would work.
No. No. I mean, that's a really interesting question. So the idea of the micro cell is you connect it to the internet. So you'd get there to Cabo, you'd connect it to the hotel's internet, and then it allows you to make phone calls. By the way, they still bill you per minute, just like they would anywhere else for the phone calls. That's a really interesting question. That sounds like a recipe for disaster. What you don't want is to get back and get a $10,000 data bill.
Right. We got the Moto G5 Pluses. Love them, by the way. And
oh, good. That's good to know. Okay, good. Yeah.
I'm on call 24/7 for work, even when I'm snorkeling or whatever. So I can't change my number by getting a local SIM while we're down there.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. So what you really want is you want local data while you're down there. And if I've used something called the SkyRoam. If you are not going to use a lot of data, the SkyRoam is a good solution. It's $9 a day, but it lets you connect 5 devices. So it's going to be less than half what AT&T was charging you. It will connect to the local data. And it turns it into a Wi-Fi access point. So it's a little orange puck that you carry around, and it's a Wi-Fi access point. I've used this internationally. It's 4G LTE. It's fast. It has a built-in 6,000 milliamp hour power bank. You can even use it to charge your phones. They don't bill, though, the biggest issue, which really makes me crazy. You only get 500 megabytes a day, and then it slows down. It doesn't cost more, but it does slow down.
Yeah, throttling isn't that much of an issue. But
if you don't think you're going to, if you're not going to be, you know, using a huge amount of data, this is a great solution. You know, you'll take it to the pool, whether you take it to the beach, you keep it in your purse, you know, as you're driving around. It works in 130 countries. You can either rent the SkyRoam or you can buy it. I actually bought one because I thought I was going to use this a lot. And I'm actually not using it as much as I thought, partly because I have T-Mobile and partly because of this 500 megabyte limit. It's a little disappointing. I think it's 500. I better check.
Yeah. She talks to Google all the time, all day, asking lots of new questions.
Yeah, so she may run through it. Yeah. She may run through it.
Better off paying the evil empire.
No, you can also, when you get... So here's a wiki that'll be very useful for you. It's called Prepaid with Data. And if you Google Prepaid with Data wiki... Why is Google so responsive these days? I'm going to take my phone and put it far, far away. If you, search for prepaid with data, I'm going to say Bing from now on if you don't watch out, phone. If you Bing prepaid with data, wiki, you'll find it, and it goes country by country. And what it talks about is the availability of local hotspots in that country. So what you could do is, instead of getting the Skyrim Solus, get from a Mexican carrier the similar device. You'd probably get it at the airport when you arrive, and you give it back when you're done. You're basically renting it for the week. They usually have much better prices. But the nice thing is you can check this online and see how much you'd save over AT&T.
Prepaid with data, you said?
Prepaid with data wiki.
I'll check that one out.
Because it's a wiki, it means that people are always updating it as they go to a country. It's such a useful resource. I give you the, you know, it's a long URL. It's prepaid-data-sim-card.fandom.com/wiki/prepaid_sim. Anyway, I'm not going to go on. As you can tell, it's ridiculous. But you can Google it and it'll go right there. And it's a really useful thing. So you can go to Mexico and you can see, oh, let's see, in Mexico, here's the four carriers and here's the prices. And here's one that will do what you want. Is sometimes I call it a MiFi card. It looks like a credit card size device. And,
yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah, and it picks up the internet from the 4G and then spreads it around usually to five other devices.
Well, I'm mostly concerned with receiving phone calls.
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. So it's more than data. You also want to get your AT&T phone calls.
Yeah, I could set up forwarding, but they'll, you know, kind of give you the red hot poker treatment for that too. So I don't
right.
want to go see.
No, you're going to get the, if you want to make sure that if look, you might say, okay, I don't mind getting phone calls. I'll make them quick. But if you plan to spend any time on the phone, you definitely need to get an international plan for the calling as well.
Yeah.
So at that point, you might just bite the bullet, give the Death Star. It's $10. You should check because most companies offer better deals for Mexico and Canada than they, you know, for North American countries than they do for the rest of the world. So you might actually get a better deal in Mexico.
Well, thank you much. I have one more piece for you, though. You said how old is your Tesla now?
The lease will run out end of July. That means 3 years in the end of July.
You're lucky that you're leasing. I'm sure you've heard about the eMMC storage issue that's happening in their ECUs where they're writing so much logging data, the eMMC is wearing out.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, little NVIDIA modular CPUs for that are going bunk because the storage doesn't work anymore.
And does Tesla pay for the fix there?
If you own it, they sure don't.
Oh, my goodness. I'm looking it up right now, and I'm seeing this. Tesla data chip can kill older models.
Yep.
Yeah, this is a problem. It's one of the reasons we don't recommend eMMC storage. It's the older form of flash storage, the kind that's in your camera or, you know, your phone.
Yeah. And there's a guy who's been learning how to fix Teslas because he bought one from a scrapyard.
That's a great YouTube channel, by the way. Much fascinating.
He released a video, I think, 2 days ago where he came out here to the proper coast and showed the guy's tech bench. And you can see both of their ECU models. The more modern ones have been upgraded to an integrated Intel Atom CPU, and their fix was to just put a gargantuan eMMC chip in, so it won't use up all the right side.
Yeah, it's not covered by the warranty, and when it dies, by the way, if Tesla can't collect that data, your car will not start. That's it. Yep. And Tesla's not warrantying it. If you're out of warranty, Tesla does not stock the part, nor will they service it. You have a non-working vehicle. This, by the way, in a nutshell, is why I probably won't buy another Tesla. I love my Tesla, but I have to say the company is not the best-run company in the world. That's disappointing.
Thanks for helping.
Thanks for the tip. No, I'm glad I'm turning it in. Yeah, my wife's idea. She said, lease it. We're not going to. This is too new technology. We're going to lease it, not buy it. And, boy, she was smart. Have I said that lately, Lisa? Boy, you're smart. Thank you, Lisa. Boy, you're smart. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls still to come. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up in just a few minutes. He made me pledge not to take pictures for 2 weeks. I'm 1 week in. I'm going through withdrawal. We'll talk about it coming up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, loving to party. 8888 Ask Leo. I am a Tesla fan, and I often want to defend Tesla because there are lots of people who attacked Tesla kind of more out of their own prejudices. So there's people who don't like Tesla who just want it to fail. Some of them are shorting it. They're shorting the stock. That's what Elon always says. Oh, it's those shorts out there. They're trying to get us to fail so they'll make money on their stock. Then there are people also who just resent Elon Musk and resent the attitude at Tesla. There's a certain nose in the air with Tesla. There are people who hate electric cars in general. It's been a big problem at the Tesla supercharger stations with people parking their trucks right there to block the power. It's kind of a thing. It's a protest, I guess, against electric vehicles. It's a futile protest because electric vehicles are the future around the world. And I think you're going to see gas stations and gas vehicles starting to go away as electric vehicles take over for a variety of reasons. So I often, you know, will defend Tesla against detractors. And I love my Model X. I love my Tesla. As most Tesla owners will say, we love our Teslas, but there are problems. There is trouble in paradise. And one of the biggest problems is related to this memory problem, which is that Tesla doesn't seem to be keeping parts in stock. It's difficult sometimes if you need body repairs or fixes. I've heard of people waiting a long, long time after an accident or a broken window to get it fixed. This is growing pains. You know, Tesla's growing very fast. But it's also discouraging. And I think what's happened is, at least for me, is when Tesla was the only choice and the supercharger network was out there and the only really good choice for keep getting power as you traveled around, it was a no-brainer. But there are many choices out there now. There are more and more electric vehicles out there now. And this is a little disheartening, this memory chip failure. The thing to remember with Teslas, anyway, is essentially what you have is a high-powered golf cart with a nice body on top of it and a very sophisticated computer system. The problem is if the computer system fails to work, so does the car. And in this case, if that memory chip fails, according to a number of people who've had this happen, when it fails out of warranty and Tesla doesn't have a replacement, your car, your fancy car, is bricked. Like any computer, it won't boot up. The chip is inside the media control unit. You might say, well, big deal, right? I can live without a radio. No, but it collects data logged by the media system. And apparently, like any chip, once it's been written to the maximum number of times, the chip fails. It doesn't control any of the car's driving functions, but it's so tightly integrated into the controls that when it fails, you lose access to climate control. In some cases, the car could charge incorrectly and not be drivable. And according to a video on the YouTube channel Roadshow, it could fail after a few years of use. So that is a real cause for concern. I would expect a response from Tesla and a way to fix this pretty darn quick. Pretty darn quick. But you can see that it's going to be hard for Tesla going forward when there are other choices. And that kind of breaks my heart because I think these guys, they're, you know, as crazy as Elon comes off, his heart is in the right place. And I think he really does want to make the world a better place. Honestly, that's his goal there. 8888 Ask Leo. Back to the phones we go. Andrew in San Jose. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, what's up, Leo?
What's up?
So I have a Mark One Razor phone, the original one.
Wow.
And it's running an Android 8.1 Oreo.
Oh, that's good. You must have done that yourself, yeah?
I kept tabs on the update button.
Oh, okay. But, all right. So it did. So that's nice. Good for Motorola. They kept it up to date. Good.
Razor.
Or, I'm sorry, Razor. Not used to be Motorola. All right. Razor.
Not those old.
Oh, you have that gaming. Oh, now I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Not the Moto Razor. That's why I was surprised. Oh, you have the gaming phone. Oh, nice. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I, for what I use it for, I like it. I just wish it had a better camera. Actually, there are a few issues with it. Like, I can't really use my front-facing camera anymore because so much dust has gotten into
it. Oh, dear. Yeah, they'd never made a phone before, so there's always that. But their whole idea was we're going to make a super high refresh screen, a lot of horsepower. This is going to be the killer gaming phone. Do you game on it?
I like this. Every once in a while. Actually, not that often anymore, but when I travel and stuff, it's useful. I really do like the refresh rate.
Nice.
I like the sound.
Good.
Those are my two, like, sellers.
Yeah, it could be just a great media phone. Yeah.
Yeah. So I basically use it as a media phone. So my issue with it, though, is I was, just doing some maintenance and looking around, and I noticed my storage was getting low, so I added a 256 SD card to it once I bought it.
Yep.
And it's really strange, because when I go into the storage in the settings menu, it says, it gives me internal shared storage and Samsung SD card. When I go into that, it says I only have, I've used up 215 gigs of my 256.
Wow. What do you got on there?
Yeah. That's my question. So I don't actually take that many pictures with it. Like I said, the camera is not that great. Although I did, another funny story, I did go to Japan last year around the same time you went.
Oh, nice.
I noticed that. And I'm going to Hawaii this year.
So. Oh, wow. You're following me around. No, you just have good taste.
Yeah. But so I did take quite a few pictures and videos then. But I was using Google Photos. So the weird thing is when I go into my Google Photos and I want to, free up space, it only says it'll free up about 15 gigs.
It all has to be backed up before it'll delete it. So make sure that all the photos are backed up. The other thing you can do is you can pop that card and look at it and see what's on there. Because maybe it's just temp files or cruft. Maybe it's not stuff you really want to keep. You can even format that card. So pop it out of the Razor, put it, mount it on your computer and take a look. Maybe there's something in there that you don't need. Have you tried that?
I figured I could probably brute force it, but what I'm afraid of is messing with the files or how it interacts with apps. The weird thing is when I, look at it in the storage, it says 85 gigs is used on apps and 130 gigs is used on system. And nothing else.
Yeah, it sounds like it's storing cache files there or something weird.
Yeah, so there's actually an other tab which says negative 1.1 gigs. I don't know what that's about.
Wow.
So that's what I'm calling about, is why is there so much systems, what's being classified as system?
I bet it's cache files, temp files. One thing... Somebody in the chat room is saying bleep blurp, and it is potentially some. You can get counterfeit micro SD cards that say 256 and aren't.
Oh no, this is definitely a Samsung. I bought it,
It's an EVO, Samsung EVO, and it's definitely 256. Okay.
So the thing is.
I bet you, if it's system files, but it's undifferentiated, it's probably cache files, temp files, and probably safe to delete it.
It says system includes files used to run Android version 8.1, so it won't even let me explore those. So if there's another way for me to just easily find out where it's using all the memory, that would help. But it's weird that it's not, classified. Is that a normal thing with the SD card?
No, I haven't seen that. I've seen it with iOS. iOS has a big other section that's garbage. Look at – do you have the Google Files app? Google makes an app. It's fairly new called Files, Files by Google. It's on the Play Store. And it has a cleanup function.
I have a – Well, so I have the Android Files button that came with the Razr.
No. Yeah, download Files by Google. It's newer.
Okay. I did try using ES File Explorer.
Don't use that. That thing's bad news.
I can't even understand how to use it.
They got purchased, and it's now got malware in it, all sorts of stuff. In fact, that's something to be aware of, is it's possible you've got, something else on there. A coin miner, Bitcoin miner or something on there occupying all that space. So absolutely get rid of ES Files Explorer now.
Okay.
That used to be my recommended program, and they got sold, And now they're owned by a scammy company that's putting weird stuff on
there. Really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
So get rid of that. Do get the files by Google, from Google. It has a cleanup thing. See if that helps.
Okay. Oh, so the, another thing is, so the math just doesn't seem to work for me, because, like, if go into the storage and then, like, there's a free up explore. I think when I look into my, like, camera file and then, oh, yeah, so it's a Samsung SD card. Oh, okay, never mind. That's just the check. Okay,
it's not unusual if they're not reporting what's on there. It's not unusual for it to kind of not add up. Honestly, in the long run, if you can't get it to work, make sure your pictures are backed up, then just format the card and start over.
Yeah, I was just hoping there'd be an easier way.
Well, try this try the files by Google. See what the cleanup does there.
Okay.
Make sure it really is a 256 gig card.
I bought it from Fry's, so I assume it is.
Oh, I would not assume that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
I'm not going to say anything, but I would not assume that.
Really?
Yeah. Put it in the computer and look and see what the actual capacity is. Yeah.
Well, I'm fairly certain, but okay, I will double check.
Yeah, I would.
Okay. Well, that's good advice for me. Thank you.
Sure. Take care. Mama, don't take my Kodachrome. Leave my... It's time for the photo guy. Chris Marquardt's here from discoverthetopfloor.com. He is our genial digital photography guru. He has taught me everything to know about wide-angle photography, film photography, and right now he has me on a cleanse, a photographic cleanse. I can't take
How
pictures
hard is it?
For 2 weeks. It's hard. I was complaining, my mistake last week, that I've just lost my mojo, that I don't have the artistic oomph to take pictures.
And here I am trying to use my hobby reverse psychology to get you.
I think it's working. You're making
photography
me mad.
Again. do it for another week and then we'll see.
You know what is happening is mentally I'm starting to think about all the pictures I want to take. So that, I think that's a
right.
Good, I think that's a good.
Oh yeah, definitely. Any change at this point is going to be helpful, and that might just trigger that change.
And I tell people this because I think it's important to understand. Any artist will go through spells where they just don't feel creative.
Oh yeah. I do that. I sometimes have an entire month when it's winter and the season is over, and I'm just doing office work and the light is not nice. I might just not touch a camera for an entire month. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Wow.
Well,
I'm impressed. So what do we want to talk about today?
Well, I have found three reasons to use cameras that are kind of a bit different from what you would think of use for a camera. So let me talk about them. The first one is to save money. And it has nothing to do with your photography, but this has to do with autonomous driving. Now, you know how a lot of manufacturers use a system called LiDAR, which is you sometimes see on these autonomous test vehicles. You see these things, these humps on the top and this rotating thing that tries to get like a 3D view of the surroundings. Now, researchers from Cornell have come up with a study that claims that cameras can do pretty much the same as LiDAR at a fraction of the cost.
This is what Elon Musk was saying. He said, I don't need the LiDAR in my cars. I got cameras.
And when I heard that, I was like, yeah, okay. But this seems to support that statement.
Yeah, LiDAR is expensive. A LiDAR camera
instead of a LiDAR, yeah, $10,000 easily. And if we're talking cameras, that's a couple of tens of dollars. So that is impressive if that is really possible. So what they do is they use stereo cameras and then convert that 3D. You know, your smartphone might have two cameras and it knows the depth, it knows 3D in the picture. So that's pretty much the same. And then it converts that to what's called a point cloud in the LiDAR world. And it's pretty much almost the same. At least that's what the Cornell people claim. And
you do a podcast called The Future of Photography, in which you talk a lot about computational photography. That's the buzz phrase. That's what this is, basically.
That is one way of computational photography. use multiple cameras and then make something different out of that based on the data. And there's like AI behind it or machine learning and so on. But yeah, seems that that is a way to save a lot of money. So this is one way to use cameras to save money. The second one is to fight fire. Because I just read that the Paris Fire Brigade used off-the-shelf drones and thermal cameras during the Notre Dame fire.
No kidding.
And yeah, they had like DJI drones that they hung thermal cameras under, so these cameras can see
hot
heat.
Spots.
They can see where hotspots, pretty much. Yeah. That's what they're looking for. And they used this not only in the aftermath to find places that were still kind of dangerous, but during fighting the fire to see the best attack, best angles of attack to make their job easier. And this is a general trend that we see in different places. Flying cameras are used in rescue operations, in firefighting, and all sorts of things that wasn't possible before, these kind of flying camera platforms. So that's an interesting move for sure. And then last but not least, here's one that is kind of far out. This is really a future of the photography topic. Because some researchers are using cameras to see things that are really, really far away. Now, you've seen the zoom in the Huawei P30 Pro in this smartphone that has like this amazingly long zoom range.
Yeah.
Now, researchers of the University of Science and Technology of China in Shanghai came up with a camera that can take pictures from 45 kilometers away. That's like 28 miles. And not just that, through city smog. So we're talking a camera that can take pictures at an almost impossible distance. Now, of course, you have to do something about Earth's curvature. So you have to put the camera high up on a building. But they have an interesting technology that they call single photon detection, which is in combination with lasers shining light on things and the travel time of the light coming back, they can pretty much build pictures of things that are almost 30 miles away through smog. And they don't really look quite like what you get from your camera, but kind of look more scientific at this point.
But the data is there. It's able to extract the data. It's really remarkable. And this is, again, computational. Taking the data you get from the camera and applying a lot of processor to it.
Right. And I have links for all these three. I'll send them to you so you can put them in the show notes.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very impressive stuff.
It's exciting times for photography. And what really hits home is that because the camera doesn't have to be a big, expensive, full-frame sensor, that you can do these things with a smartphone, which is essentially a kind of anemic camera attached to a powerful computer, and the powerful computer can make up for the anemic sensor in the.
That's a good way to put it,
it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
But then there's also the real photography where you travel somewhere and go to places and experience the whole thing. Yeah. That's the entire side.
I wish I could go to Bhutan. That's where I want to go. How can I go?
We just added Cappadocia.
Oh!
300 wild horses in the Cappadocian grasslands.
And also, that's where they do the hot air balloons in Turkey, right?
Oh, and you can take really surreal photos with tens of hot air balloons rising into the sky during sunrise with a herd of wild horses that gallops across the landscape below. So,
oh man, you live a good life. If you want to see Chris Marquardt's amazing travel workshops, photography workshops, go to his website, discoverthetopfloor.com. This is in Turkey, Cappadocia, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah. Wow. And fairy chimneys, horses, hot air balloons. It sounds
horsemen.
Like perfect. It's in underground cities. It sounds perfect.
Carved underground cities in the rock.
I can't wait. Chris, discoverthetopfloor.com. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you our assignment for this week, because it's a good one. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Thank you, Chris Marquardt. More of your calls right after this. Tech Guy podcast brought to you today by FreshBooks. Man, I love FreshBooks. Save my buns. Saved me some years ago when I had to send invoices. I don't have to do that anymore, thank goodness. But if you do, you know sending invoices at the end of the month is about as unfun as paying bills at the end of the month. They're very similar. Sending them, paying them, it's all the same. And I always kind of hesitated. I got to fire up Word and Excel. And I was sending invoices up to Rogers in Canada, so I had to convert it to Canadian dollars. I had to get all collect all my expense receipts, put them all in the invoice. It was just a pain. So what happened was sometimes I would just not do it for months. And that's when I learned a very valuable lesson. If you don't send the invoices, no one pays the invoices. You've got to send them to get paid. Amber MacArthur told me about FreshBooks. Saved my life. Made it very easy to make invoices. You do it all in the FreshBooks interface online. Professional-looking invoices. You can even take payments online, so it makes it easy for your clients to pay. In fact, that's one of the best things about FreshBooks invoicing, is because you can accept online payments, and because clients hate paying bills as much as you hate making bills, when they see that button that says pay now, they go, okay, well, I'm looking at it, I'm going to pay it, and it's done. Yay! On average, FreshBooks users get paid twice as fast, and I'm convinced that's why. It's accounting software. Now, don't let me scare you away with that. It's the number one accounting program. It makes billing painless. But you don't have to do anything special to make an accounting program. By simply sending out your invoices, taking pictures of receipts, putting them in the invoices, or just storing them. By keeping track of which invoices are paid, FreshBooks does that too, which are overdue. They'll even send out little overdue reminders, all that stuff. They're doing your books. You know, you got accounts receivable, accounts payable, you got expenses, you got everything. They'll even dial up your bank and download expenses from there. Which means on the FreshBooks front page, you will see at any given time if you're making money. When tax time comes around, it couldn't be easier. You got all the paperwork you need. Your accountant will love you. You don't need accounting experience. It just does it for you automatically. FreshBooks, create and send invoices, accept credit card payments, log every expense with a snap of the camera. The FreshBooks app is fantastic. iOS and Android. Stay on budget for every project by tracking what you've spent. Track your productivity. Of course, you could do time and hours billing. You can even have different rates for different projects from the same customer. It's all built into the app or on the website. Easy to understand reports, multi-currency billing, automatic tax calculations, and so much more. And because FreshBooks is a web application, totally secure, safe web application, it's always getting new features, new updates. You're constantly evolving to keep up with your customer. FreshBooks ensures you have all the information and tools you need to understand and grow your business. And the FreshBooks mobile app has revolutionized the software accounting world. Communicate with clients, get paid, organize expenses all in the palm of your hand. I love it. FreshBooks is used and trusted by small business owners in over 120 countries. Over the years, 24 million people have signed up to use FreshBooks. You should too. In fact, you can get a 30 days free trial right now at FreshBooks.com/tech guy. And don't forget to put the tech guy in the how did you hear about us section. So thank you, FreshBooks, for supporting our podcast. Thank you for supporting it by going to FreshBooks.com/tech guy. And when you enter the tech guy in the how did you hear about us section, you'll get 30 days free. It's an amazing thing. Don't suffer. Just get her done. I should really do these ads at the end of the month when you're really suffering the most, right? It's coming. FreshBooks.com/tech guy. Use tech guy in the how did you hear about us section to get 30 days free. Thank you, FreshBooks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. So one of the things Chris does, our photo guy, is gives us every month an assignment. It's not a competition. It's just excuse to get out there and take pictures, break through that creative log jam. See things with a new eye. Our assignment this week is to take a picture of a building. It's very concrete this time. A building, noun, building. Take a picture of a building. Find a way to make that interesting, creative, beautiful, whatever it is you need to do. Get some inspiration. And then once you've got a picture you're excited about, upload it to Flickr. We actually have a tech guy group on Flickr. Flickr is a free photo sharing site and really nice. I really like it. Might as well be a member if you like photography, both to share your photos and to look at others and share your thoughts about it. And once you're on Flickr at flickr.com, there's a tech guy group. It's a big group, tens of thousands of members, lots of pictures. Once a week, you can upload a new building photo, but do make sure you tag it with the word building so we know it's your submission for this photo assignment. Renee Silverman, our moderator, she's great. She'll say, thank you, got it. Put it up there. And then in a couple of weeks, Chris will come back and we'll look at the pictures. And he'll pick three that he wants to particularly talk about. So Chance, that's the prize, a chance for fame and fortune. Well, maybe a little notoriety anyway on the radio show. Building. Take a picture of a building. Mickey is in Bear Lake, California. Our next caller. Hi, Mickey.
Oh, my gosh. I got on.
Oh, hey, Mickey. I'm sorry to keep you waiting so long. Thank you for your patience.
No, oh, my gosh. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. And my problem is I have a Windows 10 laptop that went into airplane mode.
Oh.
And I can't get it out. You know, the actual toggle is grayed out.
Oh. Okay, yeah. So there are two places you can toggle on most laptops. Many laptops have a function key for airplane mode. Do you know that function key on your laptop? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
And actually, what I need to do, because I use an external keyboard, let me up.
Yeah, maybe open it up. Maybe there's something holding it down. In some laptops, it's a switch. I actually prefer the ones with a switch. And it may be on yours, and that may be the whole source of the problem, that it's switched into laptop mode, which physically turns off the radios.
Well, you know, that's the thing is, because I did Google it, and I'm not very tech savvy, and it said to hit the function key and the radio key, but there's no...
Well, it just depends. It's different on every laptop. For instance, I'm looking at a Lenovo laptop. On function,
I have a Dell.
Yeah, but I'm just saying it's different for everybody. On my Lenovo, it's on function key 8. It looks like a radio transmitter tower with a line across it. And that's, But on a Dell, it might be function key 7. I don't remember off the top of my head where Dell puts it. And it may not be a function key. Again, it may be a switch. So if you don't see a function key, and it should be labeled with...
Oh, my gosh. Lord have mercy.
It worked.
You fixed it. There's a switch on the side. Because, you know, I didn't even know there was an airplane mode on my laptop. And, and coincidentally, I was away on business, and I did fly. And I never, I carry my laptop.
You didn't even know you switched to the switch, but you did.
Probably when I threw it in my bag. Holy smokes. Well, I hope that was very easy.
Well, sometimes it is, and I'm glad that it was, and I'm glad you hanged on.
And they're telling me all this registry stuff.
Googling it is you're going to get a lot of information, but it's going to be hard to discriminate the stuff that's applicable to you. And so sometimes a human is a better resource.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad it worked, Mickey. My pleasure. We don't usually get such satisfying results.
Yeah, so quickly.
Thank you. Yeah, there's that switch. It's a good thing on the one hand because unlike a function key, which you can hit by accident, and I do all the time, you actually go and look. It's on the left side on the Dell, and you look and you see it, and you flip that switch. You do need it. It's not just for airplanes. There are times, you don't want to. If you work for the CIA, they'll say if you go through this door, you must put everything in airplane mode. So it's good to have it's on Dell. It tends to be in enterprises where they will give you those, physical switches. Now, she was looking, and this is a good thing to remember, she was looking at the control center, which is available on Windows 10. When you go into the lower right-hand corner, you get all those badges. And by the way, there's a button, the default is you've got a row of four icons, but above that there's a button that says expand. Press that, because I like to see all the icons. When I expand mine, it goes from 4 to 16 icons. There's airplane mode, location mode. It's very much like those controls that you have on your phone. I think it's probably influenced by that. Windows 10 is getting to be more, as all operating systems are, desktop or not, getting to be more like phones. But that's a handy thing to know about these little switches here. But it can't override a hardware switch. That's why it was grayed out. And that's, I think, the strong advantage, frankly, of having a physical hardware switch. Let's see here. Line 3, Scott in Sherman Oaks. Hello, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Leo?
It's going great. How are you?
I've had better days.
I'm sorry. What's wrong?
On an earlier call, I was kind of heartbroken when you said EaseUS.
Yeah.
To do backup is, that's what I'm using, and I bought it. because I've always heard it was good. But I'm trying to take a laptop that has 128 gigabyte M2 SSD and upgrade it to a 500 gigabyte.
Good. So you imaged the old one.
Yeah.
And I hope you imaged it onto a different drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I bought a nice little container to put it in, USB.
Good.
But what it did is it made that drive 128 gig with a partition, and I don't want that. I want one big
drive. Yes, I understand. And you can easily fix this. So
I can't even wipe the drive. I can't format the drive. I don't know if...
Yeah, I can help you here. So there probably, and I haven't used EaseUS in a long time, but I'm sure there are switches. There's a way to tell EaseUS, look, I'm going to take this 128 gig drive, and I'm going to put it on a bigger drive, use the whole drive. What it did is it just simply restored the partition exactly as it was. But that's fine. If you hit Windows key X...
Windows key X.
You're going to get a kind of a weird-looking little pop-up menu. Most people don't ever see this, but it's a very handy one to have around. And on that menu, there'll be something called Disk Management. That will it's going to pull up the Partition Manager, what I call a Partition Manager, which will show you all the disks, all the partitions, and how they're used. You can look at your new C drive, which is your new, I presume, your new M.2 256 or whatever, bigger drive, and you'll see that 128 gig partition on there, and you'll probably then see a bunch of slack space or empty space, unused space behind
it.
So all you have to do, now you can't do it, here's the problem, you can't do it while you're in the operating system that's running on that partition, obviously. You can't. Well, you might. I don't know. What you want to do is resize it. So under the action menu, there'll be a way to resize that partition, to make it a bigger partition. And what you'll do is resize it to use the whole drive. So that's the...
What's the action?
Well, maybe you right-click on it. I can't remember exactly the action menu in the disk management utility. Or maybe somewhere else. But there's a...
Would it be extend volume?
Yeah. So that's just going to take that volume, and you can extend it to occupy the rest of the disk.
It's not letting me.
Yeah, because you're in the you're booted into it. You're booted into it. So
no, it's still in the USB container. I didn't boot off this drive. I've taken it out and put it in back into the USB container on the side.
EaseUS also has a partition manager. We'll do this. Basically, what you need is a partitioning program that will allow you to expand or resize the partition on the drive. And since there's nothing else on the rest of the drive, that should be an easy thing to do. You can't do it while it's running, though. So, and usually, I find no problem with the disk partitioner that comes, the disk management tool that comes with Windows. Any partition manager will allow you to do that. You just can't do it with it active, with the partitions active. So you have to boot into something else. He said it's in the USB container. That may also be an issue. If it's USB, you may not have access to the drive directly. And I'm sure there's a setting. You could just, since you haven't used it yet, just do the restore again. Look in the settings to make sure that to set it so that it expands to use the whole drive. Yeah, that's what I've done too, out of sync. I do it all the time. I just did it last night. I'm not sure why he couldn't do it, but maybe because it was in a USB drive. I think if you boot up into it, put it in place, boot up into it, and then just extend it after you've already booted, I think you can do it, right? Now, I want to put FreeBSD on my laptop. How hard was that to do, DebDrop? And which laptop? I'm using, I like Linux, and I've been using Pop OS, and I'm just very, very happy, but I've always wanted to get FreeBSD on my laptop. I just have found it was challenging. Hardware support is not quite as straightforward. Okay, I have a ThinkPad T470S right in front of me. Did you use just straight FreeBSD, or did you use the PCBSD distribution? What did you use? Can't remember what they call it now. TrueOS. And are you using ZFS?
Yeah, I keep, I actually bought.
Oh, good. All right. Yeah, I know a lot of developers use ThinkPads. That's why I thought it would be easy. I went out and bought a big PC specifically for running FreeBSD. You are? Okay. All right, I might have to try it.
Well, hey. How are you, partner? Welcome to the Tech Guy Show. And we talk about tech on this show. Yes, we do. Computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, anything with a chip in it. And the phone number, if you'd like to talk about it, is 888-ASK-LEO. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you can still call us with Skype out, but do give us a ring. Do not suffer in silence. If you want advice, suggestions, fixes, 888-ASK-LEO. But also, your suggestions and advice are welcome, too. Back to the phones. Let's see. Line 4, Carrie in New Mexico. Hello, Carrie.
Hey, Leo. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for holding on.
Yes, sir. I appreciate your taking my call today. Hey, I know this is probably a really kind of an old question, but I'm trying to get some emails off of a Windows XP machine out of Outlook Express 6 and trying to get them into Windows Live Mail. But I keep running into this problem that it keeps giving me a message that the folder that I put the Outlook Express, and I went to the Windows or to the store folder and copied those into a file and put it on the desktop of the new.
No, you can't do that.
Can't do that. Okay, what do I
got
to do?
You got Outlook Express has a backup command. So, let me see. Let me just make sure here. It's been a few years since I've used Outlook Express.
I know.
And a great program. I was very sad when they replaced it with Mail. I thought Outlook Express was fantastic. But they stopped development on that thing in probably 2006, so it was probably time. I guess you can just copy you're going to get two files, an IDX and a DBX file. The IDX is the index, the DBX is the database. You need both.
Okay.
So you got those both. You copied them out of, and also make sure, boy, this is, I'm looking at a crazy how to backup emails in Outlook Express 6. You'd think they'd have a backup command. Come on, Microsoft. Man. All right. And then you can take the files and put them in the same. Let's see. There is a PST export. That might be a better way to do it. Actually, I think that might be a better way to do it because you are moving now to a different program. And while you can copy those files, the IDX and DBX files from Outlook Express, I don't know if it's a guarantee that Microsoft Mail will read them. So let's do this. In the export command, so you on file, there's an import-export entry. They open the import-export wizard. Oh, this has all come rushing back to me.
Now this is, I'm talking on the XP machine, right?
On Outlook Express. Yep.
Gotcha.
Export to a file. You're going to select the personal folder file as the type of file, which is PST. That is the new standard file format, PST. And once you export that file, I am pretty sure that Microsoft Mail will have an import command that can understand it. That's the best way to do it because I think the real problem is that this format that the stuff stored in natively under Outlook Express is not the same. They've changed the format.
Yeah. Well, I just tried it, and then it keeps giving me this message. The export could not be performed. An error occurred while initialing MAPI.
Okay. Yeah. MAPI. Okay. So what we're going to now do, and I remember doing this a lot too, is rebuild the index in Outlook Express. Sometimes the index files, as I said, there's a data file, but there's also an index file. You need to re-index in Outlook Express, and I think the way to do that is to start up Outlook Express. Let me just check here. I thought it used to be you would start up Outlook Express with a shift key held down, But that maybe it looks like you actually need a third-party tool, which is crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. There's something called OE mail recovery, which is probably long gone, given that Outlook Express is gone.
Yeah.
But Scooter X has actually a link that we'll put up in the show notes to oemailrecovery.com. That's the website.
Okay, great. Okay.
And so I guess they are still around. And oemailrecovery.com has a small little utility that will re-index it. Gosh, it used to be, I mean, most programs you can do this with a command within the program or holding down the shift key, but I guess you had to use this third-party tool. You're going to re-index. That's probably why you're getting that mappy error. And then once you got it all working, then you should be able to export and import the PSD file.
Okay. I'll give that a try.
Wow. It's a good thing. Yeah. Get off of this old program. Get off of XP. Oh. I thought Outlook Express was great. Used it for years. I have a new Windows email client I really like that I tell people about called EC Email. It's not free, but you can try it for free. I'm sorry, EM email client. It's emclient.com. And it looks a lot like, I think it's kind of like Outlook Express. It has a calendar, address book, and email built in. It's very clean and easy to use, and it's modern. I like it a little better than Microsoft's own mail program, but unlike mail, it's a paid program. Although I think you can use it for non-commercial purposes for free. I really like it. Take a look at emclient.com. And that for sure would be able to import some of these old things because they're trying to get people to move up to a more modern system.
I'll give it a shot.
Give it a shot. File, click on Mars Room, click under. Okay, here's maybe you can do it. Maybe you can do it in the program. Mars Room says click on File, then Options. Weirdly, select Search. On the left, and then click Indexing Options, click Advanced, click the Rebuild button. So we'll capture that. Thank you, Marsworm. Yeah, I thought there was a way to do it from within Outlook Express, but my memory has failed me because it is many years ago. So it's weirdly in the search options. You can rebuild the index there. That's what you need to do for sure. That was one of the reasons I think Microsoft abandoned Outlook Express is that you needed to do that a lot, especially if you have a lot of email. So there you go. We're taking a trip back in time. It's as if Abe Lincoln called and said, "How do I split a log again?" Good old days of Windows XP. Oh, Windows is loathsome. I've never liked Windows Debug. I've used Linux since 1996 or 7. Unfortunately, I still every once in a while come across a program that I just have to have Windows for. So I keep a little Windows partition on my ThinkPad, but lately it's because I got that new Ricoh Theta Z1 camera and the stitching software needs Lightroom and Windows. But Linux is, especially nowadays, Linux is just so easy and nice and because a lot of what I use a computer for, there's three things I use a computer for. One, I can do on anything, including a Chromebook, which is surf the net and gather news for the shows, keep up on stuff, read articles and stuff. The other is photography, and it is a little challenging. There are some good photography apps on Linux. I've been using Raw Therapy. It's actually really powerful. It's just the UI is a little obscure, but I far prefer it to Lightroom, so that's going to be a big improvement. And then the other thing I do is coding. And all the coding I want to do is much easier on Linux than on Windows. Windows is god-awful for coding. Unless you're writing .NET code, you know. But I'm not. I have no desire to either. Yeah, FreeBSD is awesome. And I know that many of the developers use ThinkPads. I've just had a, you know, and with high DPI displays, there's just a lot of new hardware, PC hardware that Linux handles very well. But yeah, Haskell's a nightmare in Windows, but also Racket and Lisp. I like Emacs for Lisp, and you know, Emacs on Windows is a joke. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Jim on the line from Windsor, Colorado. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Leo. Glad to talk to you.
Glad to talk to you. Welcome.
Got an unusual problem.
Uh-oh. Always worries me when I hear that.
I live in the neighborhood of about 50 houses, and they're all within about a 200-yard radius. And I'm looking to see if there's some kind of a Wi-Fi transmitter that I can set up at one of the houses that I could pick up Wi-Fi from my smartphone anywhere in the neighborhood.
So you'd like to wire the neighborhood. Is this something you're doing with your neighbors or just for you?
No, not wire the neighborhood. I want to be able to use my smartphone.
Well, unwire the neighborhood, I guess.
Well, okay. I should explain why.
Okay.
We've got irrigation systems.
Ah.
And we have four separate controllers, and each one's got maybe 14, 15 zones, and we love these Wi-Fi systems, but they require cell. Coverage. So we walk around with our smartphones and we can turn on any zone from anywhere in the neighborhood so we can monitor their action, you know, and make sure they're working properly.
But the cells have to be on the Wi-Fi?
Well, the way we have a system in place now that's becoming obsolete. And this one is connected through servers somewhere we suspect out in your state. To this, so that we can operate it using our smartphones, of course, through the cellular system.
What do you have? A Ratchio? What is it that you're using?
Well, that's what we're looking at getting is a Ratchio.
Yeah,
it's a different brand, and they're.
Well, I'm actually fairly familiar with the Ratchios.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we're looking at putting in four separate Ratchios. Because they're, you know, the controllers are located. We would buy four new ones, Ratchios, install them in four separate locations in the neighborhood. But we need to be able to walk around anywhere and you know, have access to the various controllers. So, do we need to set up a router near each controller, or that, in other words, the problem.
I think a question for Ratchio support, and they're, by the way, they're very good. My guess is that only that the Ratchios communicate with one another on their own network, and that if you can talk to any one of the Ratchios, actually, there's a control unit. If you can talk to the control unit will talk to the separate units on their own private network. That's generally how this kind of thing works. Because they understand that there's going to be a control unit near your home, but that the sprinklers and the units are going to be spread out over a larger area that may not be able to connect via Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's the way our present system works.
Yep.
And maybe Bradshaw can provide that. I guess we should find out.
Yeah, whoever provided it. But I'm guessing here, because... the system I have is all within my Wi-Fi, pretty much. But I'm pretty sure that I only need to be within Wi-Fi of the control unit, and then it controls the other devices itself. They have their own private network.
Does that
make sense? And so wherever you're going to have that control center, that's the one that needs to be on your Wi-Fi.
But as we walk around the neighborhood, I'm going to be too far away from that.
Well, as long as the Ratchios can talk to each other, that's my point, is that the Ratchios don't have to talk to the Wi-Fi. Those little sprinkler heads and so forth, they're talking to one another. They have their own, I'm thinking, they have their own mesh network. But to verify that, I would call the company, because they have good support. But my sense of this, my memory of this is, and if somebody's got a system like this, give us a ring and confirm or deny. But my memory of this is you do have a control unit. That's the thing you control with your phone. You're not actually talking to any individual sprinkler head. You're talking to the control unit. that will need to be near your Wi-Fi, because you're going to have, now the phone is on the, talks to the Wi-Fi, talks to the network, then talks to the Ratchio controller. But the controller talks to the individual units over its own mesh network, its separate private network that is not, in fact, does not, in fact, have to be within Wi-Fi range. It has its own network. As long as the units are close enough together, they can talk to each other.
Okay, and I suspect they are.
I'm sure they are, because it's designed. And they're probably, you know, they're not at 2.4 or 5 gigahertz. They're probably at 900 megahertz. They're probably like a cordless phone network. They're so that goes quite far. That's my guess. But again, I'm only guessing based on my experience with this. And as I said, I never tested it. But once you connect the controller to the Wi-Fi, but the controller talks to the other devices via its own private network. And so you don't have to make sure that they're all within Wi-Fi range, only that centralized controller.
But I can't walk around the neighborhood with my smartphone and turn on.
I see.
That's what I want.
So you want to. So I get it. Well, you can, because depends on their software. Many of these kinds of apps, as long as you're on a network, doesn't have to be your network, a network, a 4G LTE network from your cell carrier, that then connects to the base unit on your home network. It's on the internet, and you control it via the internet. Many, and you know that that works because, in fact, I know it does, because I can turn on my Ratchio from work.
Yep.
Right? So your phone, as long as your phone is within cell signal,
yes,
it can then talk to the control unit at your home and turn on any sprinkler head.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely, because that's what we have now.
Yeah.
With a different company.
I would call them and just to, before you spend, because they're expensive, before you spend a lot of money on this. Hey, so the neighborhoods all got together and said, we want to have our own kind of communal sprinkler system.
Yeah, it's a homeowners association.
Nice.
Thing.
Yeah. Well, I guarantee you there are solutions like this, because even if you weren't doing it yourself, there's plenty of facilities, golf courses and so forth, that need this kind of control. And the most sensible way to do this is an internet-connected base unit, which you can then talk to. Even when you're at work, you can talk to over the internet. So your phone, as long as it's online, and it can be online on a different network, it'll be able to talk to it. And then it talks to the base stations, the sprinklers and all the various, you know, units out there. All of this, basically, these are on-off valves. So let's just say valves. It talks to all the valves over a private mesh network, and that gives it much more flexibility. I'm going to guess that's the way it's done. Putting Wi-Fi all over the neighborhood, you can do it. You'd have to put base stations. Probably every homeowner, you know, would have to have a base station. Wi-Fi usually wants to be within a few hundred feet of a valve. But I don't think that's how these units work. I don't think you talk directly to any valve. You talk to the controller, which takes care of the rest. Interesting conundrum in network topologies, but a call to Ratchio would absolutely explain how they do it. I know you can do it, because they use if this then that. You can turn on your sprinklers from work. I know that's. I'm almost certain that's how it works. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. My wife's going through a kind of a Bon Scott retrospective lately. Big Pee-wee, our musical director. He's got ESP. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Pamela Laguna Hills. Hello, Pamela.
Hello. How are you, Leo?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I am so happy to talk to you. I've listened to you for a number of years.
Bless you.
And
thank you.
I enjoy your show.
Oh, well, I'm glad I could finally be of service.
Well, I'm glad that I could connect. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Well, I need your assistance. I am trying to not only get my life decluttered, but I'm also trying to declutter my Gmail account.
You need Marie Kondo.
Well, you know what? I'm my own Marie Kondo, but the email part, I need you.
I don't think KonMarie works on Gmail. If it did, I would do it. You know what I did? I actually declared email bankruptcy, and I just kind of abandoned my Gmail account. I put a vacation message on there that says, hey, I don't use this anymore. If you need to reach me, ask me for my new address. I didn't even put it in the email because I didn't want to give it to spammers, and I just moved. email bankruptcy. It's the equivalent of, this house is so cluttered, I'm just going to leave it.
I am like done with it. And you know, they gave us so many free ones for so many years,
right,
that all of a sudden you, right, end up using them for your supermarket ones and this and that. But now I just want to get all my personal stuff off and put it someplace else.
Yes.
And leave my Gmail accounts clean and pretty much zeroed out at the end of every day. So I don't, yeah, have anything in there.
That's called inbox zero. Now, honestly, with Gmail, I don't know if inbox zero, you wouldn't do it the same way, because the whole theory behind Gmail, going back 12 years when they started it, was we're going to give you so much storage you don't ever need to delete email. But obviously, you don't want it sitting in your inbox either. In fact, just as, and I'm sure Marie Kondo would say this, just as in real life, you know, if you're decluttering, you only want to handle everything once. You don't want to pick it up, look at it, put it somewhere else so that you'll have to handle it another time. So the same thing with email. You want to pick it up once, look at it once, and dispose of it. And ideally, inbox zero, you get rid of it. You get it out of your inbox. But with Gmail, I wouldn't delete it. I would put it in what they call the archive. The archive is out of sight, out of mind, but searchable. And the theory being, well, you know, 5 years from now, you might say, boy, you know, there used to be this company that offered guacamole by mail, and I wish I could remember the name of it, and you could search for it and it would still be in your archive. So that's what I would say is, yes, let's tidy up Gmail, but let's not throw it out. That's the temptation. Delete it. Let's put it in the archive.
So is there a way to save the Gmail emails with any attachments on another, like a passport external drive?
Well, you can export it, but I would trust Google to save it.
Uh-huh.
Is there some reason you want to have your own personal? Sure, you can, but is there some reason you want to have your own personal copy?
You know, these days, I think you said earlier on the show today about, hey,
you're listening.
You got it all anyway, so, you know, what are you going to do?
It's for privacy. So there's a couple of things you can do. You can have another service gather all your Gmail from it. And you can even have another service back it all up. There are services that specialize in backing up Gmail. And a quick Google search will show you a whole bunch of those. So that's putting it somewhere else. And then you could delete it from Gmail. But Google also lets you download it directly if you want. Google is famous for this. They call it data takeout. And they will let you download any of your Google data directly to your hard drive. And so if you wanted to, you could go down to the computer store, pick up you probably don't need. I mean, I've had Gmail for, as I said, for more than a decade, and I only have 50 gigabytes of storage. You wouldn't need a giant hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, Google has a backup tool. You go to myaccount.google.com, and there's in the personal info section, there's a control your content, and they'll let you download all of your Gmail. It's called Google Takeout. Then they'll let you take out any of your data, including all of your Gmail. When you download it, it comes in a format that's not super usable, but it is text. And you can download it, and you can put it on a hard drive, and then you'll have it. What they don't do is say, and here's a great tool you can use to go through your old Gmails. But there are some third-party programs. There's one called Gmail Vault that will open up those old messages, and that'll do that all locally. So, yeah, if you want to move it off of Google for privacy reasons, or, you know, just because you're worried that maybe someday your Google account will go away, Google lets you download it. That's from your Google account, not from your Gmail account, but myaccount.google.com. Download it. Mm-hmm. You can use third-party tools to read it. There are also companies like Backupify, that's what I've used for years, that will back it up to their server. But that, you know, if privacy is your concern, that just adds to the number of people who can read your Gmail. So maybe that's not the solution. But again, I actually think that keeping it in the Google archive, out of sight, but still there, is not a bad idea too, because then it's completely searchable. You can always open the email. You can respond to the email. It's still part of the system. And then what you want to do is, and filters are your friend. I would strongly recommend, as you're cleaning up your email act, to look into filtering. I'll give you an example. A lot of the email I get is just newsletters that, you know, I signed up for something. They said, you want to get our free roses newsletter? Yeah, yeah, whatever. Or I forgot to uncheck the box. And now every week I get an email about roses by mail. I don't want to read that. I may not want to throw it out. If I want to take the time, I could unsubscribe. But what I do is I have a filter, a Gmail filter, that says if you see the word unsubscribe in the body of the email, just don't even put it in the inbox. Go straight to a box called newsletters. And it just filters everything into the newsletters. Do that with VIPs. I have a VIP inbox that's my wife, my mom, you know, people whose emails I can't safely ignore. That goes into the VIP inbox and maybe even gets flagged in other things. Filters are your friend in any email program, but Gmail for sure. Designing filters to handle the mail automatically helps you a lot, because then what happens is you focus on the mail you care about.
Right, right. Oh, this is good advice. Thank you.
I think it's a great thing to do, because email is one of those things. It's like the messy drawer in the kitchen, or the part of the garage you don't park a car in. You just end up stuffing things in there.
Yep, that's exactly right.
It becomes unusable after a while. And you could do what I did, which I think is probably the wrong thing to do, which is just move out of town. Or you can fix it. And the thing is, if you fix it and you use rules and you do it in a sensible way that's sustainable, it will stay that way. If you Google the words inbox zero, you'll see this is a whole philosophy of life, one that I've never successfully implemented.
Well, I like it. You know, we do it for our jobs where, you know, you've got to clean your email and archive things.
Right.
So it's time to do it for the personal Gmail account.
We never do it. That's right. That's exactly. I think that's a very good idea. Pamela, I'm glad you asked. That's a laudable goal. Spring cleaning.
Spring cleaning. There you go. Leo, thanks.
My pleasure. Keep listening.
Talking.
Thank you, Pamela. Yeah, I I talk a good game. I had friends, very wealthy people, who when a house became so cluttered they just couldn't move around, they just move. They wouldn't sell the old house, they just buy a new one. That's how wealthy they were. I kind of do that with email. It's a little busy in here. I don't want to delete it, though, because that may be that guacamole by mail. I might someday really want that. I might not have find that. You never know. And that's, by the way, how it all starts. How clutter begins. I might be using that someday. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. If you've got a business, you need PryLock. PryLock, as in privacy lock. PryLock Security teaches your employees how not to get you hacked. PryLock is genius. It's a best-of-breed security training platform that makes it simple, even if you're not an IT professional. Here's how it starts. You get a 3-day baseline test. Oh, this is so fun. Where your employees, without their knowledge, are going to get fake phishing emails. You know what phishing email is? It's the number one threat. Like 90% of all successful hacks start with an email that's not from who it pretends to be, the boss, but from a bad guy. You get the idea. You get an email that says it's from your bank and log in because something's going wrong, but it's not your bank. With spear phishing attacks, which are targeted attacks at businesses, and by the way, this is how most businesses ended up getting hacked. It's how Sony got hacked. It's how the DNC got hacked. You get a spear phishing attack that says something like, this is the boss. Here's a spreadsheet. I need you to work on this tonight and bring it in the morning. They double click on it. It's not a spreadsheet. It says, do you want to enable macros? They say, yes, they're hacked. But this is why in business it's death. It doesn't just hack them. It then spreads to your entire network, ransomware, and you're out of business. So we get this 3-day baseline test where they get fake spear phishing attacks. And depending on how they respond, they'll get training specific to that response. A custom user page loaded with resources. There's also the security awareness training. I took this and it was, I completely agree with it. A lot. He says, Dan, the guy who created this, said, well, I got a lot of ideas from your show. It's taught by a hacker. It has a 10-question final assessment for compliance mandates. So it is absolutely works with compliance requirements. It's fun because they actually get to design phishing attacks. They can actually send phish emails to friends and colleagues trying to trick them. After they take the test, then Prilock continues for the next year with 24 random phishing emails throughout the year to see if they're still paying attention. And if you click, you get specific training videos in everything from open the email to click the links to downloaded attachments, enabled macros, no, data entered for credential theft. Yeah, here's my bank account, no problem. And then they'll get the training kind of to reinforce what they've already learned. You know, there's people will go around, they'll drop, they call it a candy drop. They'll leave little USB keys lying in your company parking lot, hoping an employee will pick it up and stick it into the laptop and thereby infect your whole network. You say, oh, that would never happen. Except remember the Secret Service at Mar-a-Lago when they caught that Chinese woman with all those malware-infested USB keys? What did the Secret Service agent did? He put it in his computer. They need Prilock, too, at the Secret Service. They also have as little as $200 for 10 employees. They also have single license gift cards for your friends and family that fall for these all the time. It'll test them with 2 tests a month for a year. Prilock is amazing. You'll never learn how all the ways the hackers might use to con and trick you, but you can learn the psychology. You can learn why they do it, how they're thinking, and you can show your employees exactly what to avoid so they are not the next victim. Learn more at prilock.com/twit, PRILOCK.com/twit. Promo code Leo, you'll save 30%. Thank you, Dan and the Prilock team, for supporting Twit. And thank you for supporting Twit by using that URL, prilock.com/twit, and the offer code is Leo. Prilock! I won't play the whole thing, but Mama was very important. That's all you need to know. Happy Mother's Day. We can stop right there, Big Pee Wee. Happy Mother's Day to all of you, to all the big mamas out there, especially mine. And I hope you have a wonderful, special day. And I hope your kids call you and they send you flowers and do nice things for you. Let's wind up our Mother's Day show with a couple more calls. Kathy in Upland, California. Hi, Kathy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, hi, Leo. Thanks for my call.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hey, so I'm one of those people that learned the hard way how you should have multiple backups. So I had a computer that was on the blank, and my son's kind of a techie. So he said, well, here, let's back everything up onto your external hard drive. And then he wiped my computer clean so he could reload whatever. So then I was messing with my external hard drive, accidentally dropped it on the carpet. It wasn't even a hard drop, but those things are really sensitive, apparently. And so I took it to the Geek Squad, and they sent it off to the lab because it was, you know, it had to be in a dust-free.
You got a bad luck. You got the worst case scenario.
Oh my gosh, that was terrible.
Usually they do survive a drop. Sounds like what happened when it got dropped is a platter inside got bent, broken. Maybe the head that records on the platter got bent.
If you've got physical problems
inside the hardware, that's right. They have to send it to a special lab, and it's very expensive. And they still couldn't fix it.
No. They said, you're the, 2% of the people we couldn't help. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Even though it was going to be over $1,000, I have important files on there, my work stuff. And so I'm like, oh, my gosh. So in the meantime, I thought, well, it's a Seagate. I mean, if there's just a part that's in there, can't I just get someone to...
Well, no, that's what that company does. That's what that company does. If they said they couldn't fix it, that's what they... The reason they're in a bunny suits in a dust-free environment is they're going to disassemble the drive, replace any parts, because they have identical drives to that Seagate, replace any parts, put it back together, and if they still can't read it, nobody can read it.
Really? There's not... No, I thought maybe... Because this was back in 2015, and I've been still wanting to get it fixed. I thought maybe by now there'd be...
Well, I don't know what company they sent it to. I'll tell you the company I use and I really like, but it's not... You're right. It's going to be thousands of dollars. They're called Drive Savers.
Okay, let me write that down.
DriveSavers.com. You can call them. They have grief counselors. I am not kidding. I am not kidding because, well, you know why.
Yeah.
This is like a relative's passed away. This is like, there's something on there you just have to have. It's worth $5,000 for you to get back.
Oh, well, maybe not five.
Well, I mean, talk to them because it can be very expensive. But honestly, Drive Savers, of all the companies that does this, they do the best job. They have everything. If they can't fix it, then really it is unfixable.
Okay. Well, a lot of times they just do a minimum charge just to see if they can fix it, like 150.
You know, talk to the grief counselor, because one of the reasons you might be boo-hooing is when they tell you the price.
Oh. Okay, so try to save her.
It is not cheap.
Oh, my gosh. Well,
yeah, it is not cheap. But, yeah, that's why you back up. I mean, I've always said that the people who back up are the people who've lost data. They learned the hard way.
Yeah, now I have two external hard drives, and it's on my computer. So
yeah, you want three copies of everything, and ideally, you'd take one of those hard drives every week. You'd take it to work so that if there's a fire and you lost everything, you still have a copy at work. Like, you rotate it. Take it to work every Friday evening. Swap the drives. That you want one off-site.
I do have one at work, and I'm just trying to keep the
one off-site.
Copy on that.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I appreciate it. I'll check with them.
I'm sorry, but, you know, if they can't fix it, nobody can fix it. That's about it. That's the end of the line.
All right. Well,
I'm sorry. You just had that's really extraordinarily bad luck, because usually if you drop a drive, the way these drives are made these days, the heads retract when they're off. So they're really trying to protect, and they have shock absorbers, and they're really doing everything they can to protect against a that kind of damage. Modern drives, by the way, no moving parts anymore.
Good.
And so if you get, from now on, get SSDs, they're close to the same cost, and you will never have a problem with dropping them. There are other problems, but dropping them won't be one of them.
Okay, I'll remember that. All right, well, thank you.
I'm sorry. I wish I had better news for you, but, you know, this is the lesson. And you learn from poor Kathy. You don't want to be in that position where you're writing a $4,000 check because you need that, you know, the baby pictures or the wedding pictures or the, you know, I mean, your great American novel. Don't, you know, make sure you have backups. Everything can fail. Even, an SSD can fail too, but you got to have a backup. Nolan in Glendale, California. Hi, Nolan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Awesome, man. I'm a longtime fan, first-time caller, but you and I actually met before. We hung out at CES several times.
So much fun. I miss CES. I haven't been in about 4 years.
Four years.
Yeah, because, you know, it's kind of after a while, it's the same old, same old. But I think I want to go next year. It's in January in Vegas, and it's crazy. Everybody gets sick. You can't get anywhere. There's hundreds of thousands of people. It's nuts, but it's fun.
Yeah, well, Karen Thomas introduced us.
Oh, goodness. Well, Karen's a legend. For years.
That's for sure.
Thomas PR, her PR firm, for years, she had the party list. So if you went to Comdex and then after Comdex CES, the big geek trade shows, and you want to know, well, what parties are there tonight? She would publish that list, and she knew it all.
She was. She's awesome.
Just one more way to burn the candle at both ends. Please give her my regards. What can I do for you today?
I will. I just have a couple of actually really quick questions. The first one, you mentioned the mesh networks earlier.
Yes.
Can a mesh network be deployed utilizing a mobile app?
You mean as the base station?
If you have 10 devices and they all have the same software.
In fact, the earliest uses of mesh were exactly that, to provide mesh in areas where there was very little internet, you know, third world countries and things.
Right.
To create basically local internets where there is no internet. So that was, in fact, the very first application that I was aware of anyway of mesh networks. Now, you'll have to ask me some other time, maybe next CES, what the name of that software was, because I don't remember. But maybe if you read up on mesh networking on Wikipedia, they'll mention the early days. But that's exactly was the idea, was to provide networks for areas where there was no internet.
Very interesting. You know, yeah. I was going to look it up, but then I figured, let me call you first.
I am the historian of old, out-of-date, useless technology.
We're just a bunch of old farts.
If it's useless, I know all about it. Hey, it's great to talk to you. I hope to see you at CES, Nolan.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
You have a great day. You all have a great day. Have a great Mother's Day. Thanks to Big Pee Wee. He's going to be celebrating with his mama a little later on. Thanks to our great Heather. I'm not Heather. Kim Schaffer. Sorry, Kim. Kim Schaffer, our phone angel for answering the phones. Most of all, thanks to you for being here. Couldn't do it without you. I hate to do it without you. It's all about you. Thank you for joining me. And I see you next time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.